Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is former Judge Dan Hind from Schiffer Hicks Johnson PLLC in Houston. Welcome to the podcast, Judge Hind.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and having me.
Well, we generally like to have our guests sort of introduce themselves, give their elevator speech, sort of as it were. So why don't you tell our guests generally about yourself, your background, maybe the early part of your career?
Well, thank you. Again, thank you for having me. My name is Dan Hind. Currently, I'm a partner at Schiffer Hicks Johnson in Houston, practicing complex commercial litigation, as well as handling ADR work. Before I joined the firm at the beginning of 2019, I spent a little over 10 years as judge of the 269th District Court of Harris County. In Harris County, we divide our courts up by subject matters. So we have criminal courts, family courts, juvenile courts, and civil courts, and I have one of the civil courts, so I handled mainly civil lawsuits, but had a little bit of quasi-criminal activity along those lines. I was there for a little over 10 years. Before I went on the bench, I practiced law for about 9 years at Vinson & Elkins and had just moved to a trial boutique for a few months before the governor appointed me to fill the vacancy in the 269th. And so I was at Vincent, like I said, Vinson Elkins for about 9 years. Before that, I clerked for U.S. District Judge Sim Lake here in Houston on the Southern District of Texas. I was there for 2 years. That's back when just about everyone who did a district court clerkship did them for 2 years. And it was amazing 2 years. I got there by way of the University of Texas School of Law. I graduated in 97. While I was there, I was on the Texas Law Review editorial board. 1 year, I participated in their musical troupe, Assault and Flattery. I was in the band, and I also was involved in what was called the Aggie Law Students, which you can imagine was an interesting group to have at the University of Texas School of Law. In fact, I led a Yale practice outside the office of the dean of the law school the day before bonfire and had my picture taken and published in the Daily Texan the following day. So, you know, we in the ALS called it the A&M School of Law in Austin, but we were, of course, in the minority on that front. So obviously, I went to college at Texas A&M, received a degree in electrical engineering, and promptly went to law school. So that's how I kind of my adult life got to where I am right now.
I have a great number of Aggie friends who happened to go to that law school. And it was when I first encountered that phenomenon of the combination of Aggie and UT law grads, I always asked them, you know, how they could live with themselves because they were a walking contradiction.
Once an Aggie, always an Aggie. That's what we say.
But you all seem to have persevered. Some very good lawyers with that combination of degrees.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about your clerkship with Judge Lake. I mean, we've talked on the show about basically every variety of clerkship that can possibly be had. But largely doing what we do, most of the time what you see is appellate court clerkships. But we have had a few people who've had some district court clerkships on the federal side. And we've had a few federal district judges. Most recently, I think Jeff Brown was on our show. As you know, he is sort of a unique animal in the sense of his experience on the bench, but being on the federal district bench now, had done that for a while when he came on as a guest. But just tell us generally about your experience clerking for Judge Lake. I mean, he's kind of a legend.
It was pretty much the best job I've ever had, even when I was the boss of my own court working for Judge Lake. He's an immensely intelligent man and yet doesn't flaunt it. We would have hearings every Friday afternoon and he'd spend the morning just going through the files for the cases that were set for hearing in the afternoon. And it seems so many times he would know the case better than the lawyers who were before him. And he would never flaunt that or say that, but he He'd ask him questions that showed he had consumed some details about their case that maybe the lawyers had overlooked or that they hadn't focused on before. And so it was amazing watching him. And like I said, he didn't lord it over people or flaunt any of it. He was very humble in that sense, but immensely intelligent. In my experience watching him, he also brought an amazing temperament to it. I think I only saw him raise his voice in court twice in the 2 years I was there. Neither time had he actually lost his temper. It was calibrated to accomplish a specific priority. Like he had a witness that was about to jump out of the witness stand and come after someone, and he raised his voice, and the witness remembered who was the boss in the courtroom at that point. And so there was that combination. He also had people don't realize this about him. He has a very good sense of humor, but it's so deadpan. And he's got a reputation of being so intelligent and so knowledgeable. People walk in his courtroom, I think, a lot of times very nervous. You know, he's going to ask a question they don't know the answer to, or they're going to be caught flat-footed. And so they don't know when to kind of let their guard down and realize that he's trying to inject a slight little bit of levity in there to bring the tension down. So it was just a fantastic opportunity. The one thing I'll say, of course, I'm biased because I did a district court clerkship instead of an appellate court clerkship, but I thought I got the best of both worlds because he sat by designation on the Fifth Circuit several times. And when he was on a Fifth Circuit panel, he used us like Fifth Circuit law clerks. So we wrote bench memos. He took me to New Orleans for oral argument. And so while I didn't do it day in and day out, the kind of work that an appellate clerk did, I did do enough of it to have the flavor for it, while also having all of the experience of what happens in the trial court. I guess unless you're doing immigration appeals or certain regulatory actions, you got to go to the trial court before you get to the appellate court. And so getting that kind of experience on how a single judge approaches things and analyzes things and reaches their decision was an incredible insight to bring to the practice of law.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge. District court work and also some Fifth Circuit work while you're there. You mentioned being appointed by the governor to the trial bench and having served there for 10 years. Do you think, I mean, did your experience with Judge Lake influence how you conducted your own courtroom while you were sitting on the trial bench?
I think there was no way it could not have influenced it. One of the things that made Judge Lake such an incredibly good judge is he has a very methodical and systematic approach to his job. And he taught me and all his law clerks about, you know, just kind of step-by-step analysis, sober reflection, even temperament and everything. And that a lot of what a judge does is managing a docket, managing a case with the right touch, not too heavy-handed and not too light-handed. And so, you know, one of his sayings is the most important tool for generating settlements is a firm trial setting. And so every case, as soon as an answer was on file, I'd issue a docket control order with a trial date in it. The state courts have a volume of cases that is orders of magnitude larger than the federal courts. And so it's harder to say we had firm trial settings in the state court than we had in Judge Lake's court. But the concept was still there that if we set up a schedule, and of course we can listen to the lawyers and modify it and adjust it to the needs of everyone's cases in that particular case, but set that up early so everybody knows what the deadlines are so that they can start prioritizing their work. That's a way that the judge can assist the lawyers. Another thing was just getting the work done timely. Lawyers, they want the ruling to go in their favor, but they at least want a ruling. And if you're not getting rulings out, then it just grinds the case to a halt. The case isn't going to settle because you haven't ruled on the pending motion for summary judgment. You know, and Judge Lake knew that, and I learned that. And so I figured one of the things I had to do, I tried to get the decisions right, but I had to get them out on a regular basis. And so I set up, you know, every judge does it differently, but I set up, for instance, you know, I did all my uncontested orders on Mondays, so that, because you get a flood of different things all throughout the week in a state court. And so, you know, if you just start doing things as they come in, you're never going to be able to focus and get things done in a regular manner. So I said, okay, I'll do all my uncontested order, non-suits, dismissals, substituted service, things of that nature, agreed orders, do those on Mondays. And my clerk would know to just pile them up, unless a lawyer called in and said, we need this sooner than Monday, you know, and then we try and help them out there. And then on Tuesdays, I would do my written submission docket in Harris County. We do the deadline for written submissions, 8 a.m. Monday. And so I still waited a day in case anything came in late. And then I would spend Tuesdays reviewing all the written contested motions that weren't going to have a hearing. Wednesdays, I would look at the dispositive motions and the Daubert motions that were set for Friday, because those motions usually were longer and more detailed. And so you needed more time to look at them. And they were usually less likely to actually get passed as opposed to a motion to compel or some of the other things. And then Thursdays, I would handle getting ready for the other matters I had set for Fridays. And then Fridays was my hearing docket. And of course, all this time, I could be in trial at the same time, too. So, you had to learn to manage your time and juggle it. And that's one of the things that Judge Lake is a master at. Focusing, prioritizing. He had a saying, never let the urgent crowd out the important. And the judge decides what's urgent. Of course, you do that with input from the lawyers. You know, if the collateral is being loaded on a ship in the port of Houston bound for North Korea, then you probably can't wait until tomorrow to decide on that. You probably need it so that the order can get down to the port in time if you agree to grant it. But, you know, my discovery deadline is in a week and I forgot to issue any discovery. And so it's an emergency that you give me an extension on my discovery deadline. It's important to the lawyer. I'm glad that they raised this before the deadline, but it might be something that I may not get to till tomorrow, you know, or something like that. So learning the prioritization and the time management skills and so forth were key influences on how I did things. But I'm sure there were tons of other things that I absorbed through my time with Judge Lake that came out while I was on the bench myself.
Well, as a state court judge, I learned, you learned before we started recording, that there's an indirect connection between you and Jody because of Jody's experience clerking at the 269th. And let me let Jody take this line of questioning, but how did that work with your clerks? Did you have any permanent court staff or did you rely on interns or in terms of helping you produce the legal work, sort of like what the job that you did for Judge Lake?
So I, from time to time, would have interns. There was a law clerk that Judge Wooldridge had hired that was still there when I took the bench, and I kept him on until he finished whatever term that I think he was about to graduate from law school, and he had a job waiting for him. So kept him on, of course. I didn't hire a law clerk. The difficulty I experienced with that is, unlike the federal courts and the courts of appeals, there's really very little budget for a law clerk for the state district courts, at least here in Harris County. And we basically were given a budget we could pay $11 an hour. And so the only people who were in that kind of pay scale that would be interested would be law students. The difficulty there was you'd have them for just a few months. And so by the time you got them trained up, they were moving on. And the areas where I could use legal-wise the help the most were areas where I was going to need someone who, frankly, was going to be around longer. And so I found myself, when I would have law student interns, I was handing them off stuff that I knew was extremely boring for them. It's useful for them to learn, but, you know, you can only, if you're not being paid or you're only being paid $11 an hour, you can only tolerate so many motions for default judgment before you go insane. It's different for me because I was paid a salary and everything. But so You know, that, and the other difference is, you know, state district judges don't have to write opinions. Sometimes we will, but you don't have to. So we're basically just signing orders. And so it seemed like a lot of make work to send projects to a law, an intern or a law clerk to write up a memo recommending what I should do when, you know, our local rules require both sides to submit proposed orders. And so if I'm going to grant, I sign one order. If I'm going to deny, I sign the other. And so I didn't think that I was going to be giving the law clerks a very good experience, other than they'll get to see a lot of trials, which would be nice, but it didn't seem like it would necessarily be the kind that they were signing up for. And I didn't feel right in bringing people on to do that. I did find one area where it was productive, and that was in high school and college interns, to be quite honest, because I could hand them work that was not necessarily, I couldn't give them legal work, like review and analyze this motion for summary judgment. But there's so much else going on inside a court that we could use help on because we're so understaffed, that you could have interns helping out on that front. And so it's not the legal work, but there was other type of work out there. And I found a few diamonds in the rough that in that process. And one of my college interns went on to be one of the chancellors at UT Law School and then clerked for Judge Lake and now is an associate at Gibbs and Bruns. And so she did it all on her own, but I'm still going to try and take credit for, you know, finding her, you know, discovering her and setting her on a path. But like I said, she did it all on her own. She's incredibly bright and intelligent and is going to be a great lawyer. But that's kind of how I did it. It, frankly, I'm going to blame it on the budget. If we had a budget where I could have paid a law clerk, like the courts of appeals can pay a briefing attorney, I would have hired one and handed them off. But we didn't have the budget for it.
I completely understand. And actually, I think I was making $10 an hour when I did it. The thing that was great for me was the flexibility of it. You know, I could come in for a couple hours here, a couple hours there, and that's what worked well. But it was a good experience. The best part was getting just to see all the trials, because you just got to see so many civil trials on every possible thing you can think of, because Houston's just such a great legal market, which is what I loved getting to do. That was a lot of fun.
Now that I mediate cases, when I introduce myself to the parties, I tell them, you know, I was a judge for 10 years in Harris County. If there's a kind of case that can be brought in a civil court in Texas, I've seen it after 10 years. A oil and gas royalty case for a well here in Harris County is still producing and paying quantities, which so I even had that to tell them about. So there were those kinds of experiences there. And you're right. I mean, we see all kinds of stuff in the state district courts in Harris County. And so you did get a great experience seeing that activity.
I hadn't really thought about it that way, but what you just said sort of hit home. You know, that 10 years on the bench as a trial judge, I could totally see how in your ADR practice and in your complex commercial lit practice, you know, that would be a huge advantage to having seen so many cases come, see what has worked in terms of strategy among the lawyers over that period of time and what hasn't, just as importantly, and be able to not only guide lawyers as a mediator. And are you doing arbitration work too, or is it primarily mediation? Okay. Well, then you continuing to be the decider, as it were. I'm sure it's a role you're comfortable with, but also extending that into the litigation world as well. That has to be a really nice advantage for you.
Yeah, it's been helpful. I've mediated several trade secret cases and non-compete cases, amongst other things. And of course, you know, I saw the really good trade secret cases that resulted in jury verdicts for the plaintiff. And I saw the cases that didn't even get a TI granted. And so I can tell folks, I tell them in mediation, look, I don't get to decide who's right or wrong here. But, you know, there have been times I've told the plaintiff, I'm not seeing the kind of evidence I would see in winning cases. Like, you did a forensic audit of the laptop and you discovered that they downloaded 10,542 files 1 hour before they walked out of the building for the last time. You know, those are the cases that usually result in a favorable ruling for the plaintiff. Or I can say to the defendant, look, you know, I don't get to decide this, but they've got a ton of evidence on you and you're going to have to do a lot of explaining at trial to explain why you took 15,000 files an hour before you left the office. You know, so yeah, it does help on that front.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
One of the major reasons why we asked you to come on the show, Judge, is because of your position as chair of the oversight committee for the pattern jury charges among the different committees that exist. And you can probably list them off probably without being prompted. But, you know, we have, just as by way of background for the listener, we have several different volumes of pattern jury charges that lawyers, judges get together and produce. Just this, by way of example, to kind of move things along, we have a general negligence and intentional personal torts and workers' compensation volume. There's a malpractice premises and products volume, business consumer insurance and employment volume, which I was fortunate enough to be a member of that committee for a few years. And then we also have family and probate, and then separately oil and gas. But that's, I guess, five or six committees that I just rattled off. But there's another.
Don't forget the criminal.
Oh, I can't forget the criminal. Yeah.
And they have three volumes.
Okay. Now, thank you for correcting me on that. That is important. But one thing that folks don't really know much about, I don't think, is that oversight committee, sort of the additional committee on top of all of those. Tell us your role on that committee and kind of what it does.
Absolutely. You rattled off the names of what I call the subject matter committees. And each of these committees, their responsibility is the subject matter of their volume and looking at the pattern jury charges, seeing if any need revisions, see if any need deletions, see if any need to anything new needs to be added. There are, as we said, six committees with eight volumes, and we try to keep, we want a consistency in the way we charge juries across the state. That's why we have a pattern jury charge. And what we, I guess, we're finding several years ago is we're starting to see some different paths taken on some common matters amongst the various subject matter volume. And so, for example, proximate cause is going to be charged or is going to be found in general negligence. It's going to be found in malpractice. It's probably going to be found in oil and gas and probably in business and commerce because you will have some torts in there where proximate cause is a doctrine. We want to make sure that all the volumes, charges, and instructions on proximate cause are consistent with each other. We don't want to have something where, you know, the plaintiff is proposing PJC X and they can point chapter and verse on this instruction job, and the same topic is also in another volume, and so defendant's giving a different one, and the judge is going, okay, there is a difference between what these instructions or these charges say. Are they material? Why do I have to decide this? Isn't that the point of, if I'm going to go by the PJC, shouldn't I be able to use the PJC? So one of the reasons we have the oversight committee is to look for problems with consistency on cross-volume doctrines. And I gave proximate cause as an example, but there are other areas. You know, every one of these volumes has a chapter on preservation of error. You know, there's others about just kind of the whole process. And we have, of course, in Rule 226A, the mandatory boilerplate that have to go into jury charges and so forth. And so there's stuff that's common through all of them. And oversight's kind of there, first of all, to watch out for making sure everything's consistent with each other, with the law. That's another issue that can come. We need to make sure it's consistent with the law. And it's also consistent with the way that we instruct juries. You know, we do broad form here, and some volumes have more experience in broad form charging than others and in writing charges. And so, there, you know, if you spend enough time reading the PJCs, which as a trial judge, I spend a ton of time reading them, you just absorb, and it's almost hard to kind of really iterate exactly how to write charges, but there's a way that we write them and you get a sense for the feel that we write them. And so there are rules and standards that we go by for that, but part of the oversight process is to make sure that we're still doing that. An example, you know, our negligence question is, did the negligence of Don Davis proximately cause the injury in question? It's not, do you find by a preponderance of the evidence that Don Davis breached his duty of care and that that breach proximately caused injury and that that injury proximately resulted in damages? But sometimes when we've had some volumes look to create a new charge for a topic that we haven't had a charge for before, we'll get a question that starts out with, do you find by whatever the standard of evidence is? So you have that. And, you know, another thing we try to do with our questions is keep them simple, really simple sentences. They're in the, you know, question form, but they're usually simple sentences with certain keywords in there. And then we unpack the keywords in the instructions below the question. So, for example, with the negligence, we then have a definition. Negligence is the failure to use ordinary care. That is failing to do that which a person of ordinary prudence would do in the same or similar circumstances, or not having done that which a person of ordinary prudence would do in the same or similar circumstances. I've read that instruction 100 times, and so I kind of know it. But that's the way we approach it. And sometimes you would have proposals from various volumes that packed a lot of that. So we usually put instructions into the question. And so we're also trying at Oversight to ensure that we're asking the questions in the same way. Criminal's a little different story because they've approached jury charges differently than the civil courts have. And so there's kind of a little bit of different approach there. We're still trying to make sure that they're consistent within their volumes and with some general topics there. We also do a check, really kind of a last check before you actually go in front of a judge to make sure that the law is right. And, you know, there have been a few times when the oversight committee has looked at something and asked the subject matter volume to take another look because it seems like our understanding of the law was not consistent with what they had proposed. And so that's kind of another process that we serve there.
Do you come to that stuff independently? Like, do you just kind of do a, I guess, de novo review of everything? Or is it people bring up specific issues to you? Or maybe a combination of both? Like, how do the issues end up with the oversight committee?
We mostly wait for the volumes to send stuff to us. Anything that the volumes want to change, add, or delete from their next edition comes up to the BJC oversight committee. And so we have a 2-year cycle for each volume. And so, you know, they'll start soon after their newest edition, they'll start with working on new stuff. And they try to send it to us piecemeal over, you know, 2 years instead of waiting until right before the publication deadline, because there's no way we could approve it all. But usually it's a matter of waiting for those volumes to bring stuff up because they have some long-term projects. I believe the business volume's been working on a rewrite of the contract chapter for several years. I'm hearing word that we may be seeing that pretty soon at PJC Oversight, but that's not something you just do in one or two meetings, the subject matter volume. They put a ton of work into that. And so, and because we have enough work, there's not much of an occasion for us to make work unless it's on a topic that touches more than one volume. And so, for example, a couple of years ago when the Supreme Court handled down the Roramus Ventures case on attorney's fees, where they said, we really meant it in L. Apple. You know, we finally, I think Justice Bland was the chair of the oversight committee at the time. She didn't ask the subject matter volumes. She formed an ad hoc committee that included members of all of the subject matter volumes and members of the oversight committee to look at it and see how is attorney's fees being charged in all the volumes and how should we change it, if at all, to stay consistent with Roramus Ventures. And so there will be situations where we see something major like that and we'll, you know, make a suggestion. Hey, y'all, we think y'all should go look at this now. It looks like there may be a change here that we need to adjust the PJCs. But it's mostly driven by what the PJC volume committees are generating, not what we're asking them to go do.
I think you mentioned that preservation of error provision that appears across volumes. I assume that was sort of the same sort of working process that, I mean, that's something that has plagued practitioners for generations, almost, it seems. And
that one's a little different. That one actually, because I believe that there is some more, we may be seeing in the next volumes, in the 2022 volumes, some more revisions on that. I believe some of the volumes are working. Sometimes the volumes on their own work together. like there's a lot of overlap between general negligence and malpractice. So they will on their own reach out to each other and say, hey, we need to go look at this. But on preservation of error, I think we just looked at something for the family volume on that. But it is tricky. And it touches on another thing we got to be careful with all the PJCs is what our role is. It's not to be a treatise and it's not to tell people how to brief things. It's more to touch on the major legal issues and the major legal doctrines that are governing this, the reasons why something's in there and so forth, and give people notice. Here's an issue with this charge or this instruction with the idea that, okay, we need to, the lawyer needs to go out now or the judge needs to go out now and really research that issue if they want to make an issue of it. But preservation of error is something that, yeah, it's cross volumes and the volumes, sometimes they take their own initiative. They see something and they want to suggest something. And that's a way they'll get the conversation started.
How do people get involved with the PJC process and in particular, I guess, the oversight committee?
These are all committees of the State Bar of Texas. So they go through the same process for appointment as any of the other State Bar committees. You can go on the website, the State Bar website. I don't have the link in front of me right now, but there's a link or a place where you can express your interest in being considered for one or more committees. And then there's a process there involving the folks at the State Bar. Ultimately, you're appointed by the president of the State Bar, confirmed by the board of directors of the State Bar. You can reach out if there's a particular committee. If you know members of the committee, you go talk to them. Or if you know the chair of a committee, go talk to them. There are different voices in that process. I would start with looking at State Bar website. And I think it's a process that usually you can start signing up sometime in September, October or so for the following year.
The PJCs are not treatises, as you say. I have found that in addition to actually doing charge work and preparing charges, they're really a phenomenal research tool just from the standpoint of knowing what the black letter law is on a certain issue and using that as a starting point, sort of like a very scaled down version of maybe O'Connor's, but you know, obviously not meant to be comprehensive. You can read the question, you read the instructions, you look in the comments below, and you typically see the key cases. Like as an example, you mentioned attorney's fees and Rormoose. And that question, you know, has been updated quite a bit in light of that case. But that's sort of the process that the committees are charged with, kind of keeping up on what the latest issues are, the emerging issues are that could influence how the juries are being charged and using these questions and instructions and definitions. And I'm surprised sometimes by how helpful the books are in getting me to a starting point if I'm struggling a little bit with what the law is on a certain topic.
They're great finding tools. That's the way I think of them. The same way, like, you know, a professor's case book. You know, you don't look at the casebook as all the binding precedent on First Amendment or whatever, but it's going to tell you what the major cases are that you want to start with. And so, like, I remember back when I was on the bench, I had a case where I needed to, you know, it was a bench trial, but I needed to talk about whether a breach was material or not. Well, I went to the PJC to find out, okay, what's the case that talks about materiality? It's Mustang Pipe. Okay, so that's helped. Sent me to the right case rather than trying to come up with a Boolean search or, you know, a search on Westlaw or something like that. And you just go to PJC and it tells you what the major precedent setting cases can be.
You know, the every 2-year process, you just went through a round of revisions for 2020 that came out. What were some of the things that changed for some of the 2020 volumes? And I'm not asking you to tell us every single thing because I know that's a ton, but were there any big issues that kind of came up that the oversight committee was concentrating on?
There were, I wouldn't say the oversight committee concentrates on so much as, you know, we know it was a big issue for the volumes because I don't want to understate how much work the volume committees and their members do on this. And so these are big issues for them. And sometimes there are some controversies with us, but just kind of some of the big things, we revised attorney's fees. The business and consumer volume revised the chapter on piercing the corporate veil. They had a substantial change update on that. The general negligence and the malpractice volumes had a couple of major changes to pre-existing conditions. That was probably the most substantial, or I should say the most visible work that they did, because it wasn't, it, part of it was the what's called the eggshell skull plaintiff doctrine. And, you know, whether and how that should be charged and instructed, it also looped into the general instruction for pre-existing condition. And so they, there was a lot of work. We have great lawyers. We try to make sure on all the volumes that we have lawyers from both sides of the bar. So you have plaintiff's lawyers and defense lawyers. And sometimes there are some very strongly held views that don't always mesh, but that's why we have this committee process. And so that was one where that was going on. The business volume also had a major look into the fraud question and the elements of fraud, and particularly the reliance element. And you couldn't really tell it by looking at the actual revision that they made to it, but an enormous amount of work went into their suggestion that justifiably be put in brackets in the element for reliance of the question on fraud. You see just one slight change in the red line, but there was a ton of work that those lawyers did trying to figure out whether and what to do about that. And so you see that kind of work. I'm trying to go through my notes here about some other, the negligence volume also kind of added some material on uninsured, underinsured motorists claims, and there's some changes to defamation provisions in the business volume, and the oil and gas volume added a few items. They added a question on statutory waste and a provision on the reasonably prudent operator defense. And so there's more, but those are some of the big things that the various volumes had worked on for 2020 editions for those volumes, which kind of came out at the beginning of 2021.
I hear you go through that list, Judge, and almost to a point on each one, I can think of maybe some of the drivers for the changes that were made. I mean, we've talked about Roar Moose already on attorney's fees, piercing the corporate veil. I mean, that's not a recent statutory change, but the legislature and some of the case law has made really clear what you have to show to get there, to pierce the corporate veil. And it's not the old Castleberry versus Branscombe standard, which so many lawyers don't know. And maybe you don't until you pick up the PJC volume. Fraud, I was in the room for some of those discussions. And you're right. That's a good cross-section of the bar debating what the Supreme Court meant when it held in such and such case. Did it mean to change the law? Is this a significant effect on the law? I mean, those are the kinds of debates that go on.
Didn't even hold anything on that, as opposed to it mentioned it in passing as it was addressing a different issue.
Mm-hmm. I remember one debate when on the Roar Moose point on attorney's fees that someone was of the view that most of the analysis in that Paul Green decision was dicta. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that you have to look at. But then you mentioned defamation too. I mean, that is such a tricky area of the law. And the Supreme Court has had a significant case in the last 2 years on that issue that really seemed to adjust the law fairly substantially. So, you know, these are all driven, it seems like, by just monitoring and keeping in touch with how the law is evolving, whether it be over by statute, through what the legislature is doing, or through the common law, mostly through what the Supreme Court is doing, but sometimes not, sometimes paying attention to trends in the courts of appeals too. As another example of that, though, I'll mention trade secrets, because I know that was a struggle and a big job. To the committee had to draft a set of instructions and questions from whole cloth when the legislature a few years ago enacted the trade secrets statute. And so it's also worth mentioning, though, maybe a point for further discussion. The courts don't necessarily accept these PJC instructions and definitions and questions as gospel. I'm interested in hearing from your perspective as a former trial judge. I mean, did you feel like you could pretty well rely on the PJCs, I guess, as adequately stating the law? Maybe we've already sort of answered that question because we've been bragging on what a good resource they are. But you know, sometimes the courts have said, the appellate courts have said, well, that's not exactly right. And we're going to reverse a decision in which the jury was charged, we would say maybe correctly under the PJC, but the courts have found that to be an error. What do you have to say about that, Judge?
Well, you know, it's ultimately the courts that decide those things. And the challenge that we have with PJCs is there are fewer and fewer opinions, whether the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, that are addressing a lot of these legal issues in the context of charge error. And so that's one of the challenges I mentioned earlier about how we have a consistent way of writing things and writing instructions. And a lot of times people will say, well, I got this blurb straight from Smith versus Jones. And it was part of the boilerplate throat clearing that the Court of Appeals did in one paragraph on a summary judgment before the Court of Appeals turned to the issue of the case, which didn't have anything to do with that doctrine. And so one of the challenges, as I said, is finding cases where there's charge error, because those are, to me, as a committee member, they're the most helpful in terms of figuring out how to craft a pattern jury charge. So that's part of it. As a committee member, I don't mind if the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court says this PJC is wrong, in the sense that we're trying to do better. We're trying to get this right. If they say this PJC is wrong, and we said it 5 years ago when we held that this language that you used is wrong, that'd be a different story. Then I'd be embarrassed. But usually, I mean, all the work that the subject matter volumes do and the oversight committee does, once we publish, a ton of work has gone into trying to figure out what the courts say about this. And so, you know, in terms of when they say, I didn't get it right. I mean, proximate cause is an example of that from 15 years ago when, you know, the Supreme Court kind of adjusted the way to phrase it to be more like some, you know, producing cause from DTPA. And so in Ledesma. And so, you know, sometimes the PJC's just got to go with what it's got, and they don't have good case authority. Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals feels like they need to clear the air about certain law. There is authority out there, although I don't know that it's necessarily binding authority, that when the charge error is an error where the court went with the pattern jury charge, reviewing court has the discretion to remand for a new trial instead of rendering judgment because everybody was following the PJC. And so in the interest of justice, since they were following PJC, it's fair to go ahead and let's try it. And this isn't a case where you didn't try to get the jury charge right or you ignore the PJC or something like that. It's not necessarily, like I said, mandatory that they remand for new trial, but there are, you got a Supreme Court case, I forget which one it is, a Court of Appeals cases that will say it's appropriate in that situation when there's charge error to remand for new trial. So that's an advantage there of using the PJCs. I think speaking for myself, I wish I could say I speak for most judges, but I just don't know the opinion of most judges. I thought the PJCs were a starting point, but if the lawyers could show why this particular case, you know, supported a departure or an adjustment to it, I'd listen to it. And if they had made a persuasive argument, I'd go with it. You know, sometimes you look at it and you figure, okay, if you also wanted it in that situation to be set up in a way to where the issue wasn't going to be waived on appeal, so that whatever I decided, if it went up on appeal, the Court of Appeals is going to have a chance to make the clarification if it needed to. And so you try to avoid, you know, coming up with waiver arguments and everything. But I usually started with PJCs. If there was a PJC on it, I tried a trade secret case at least once, maybe several times before we had PJCs on it. So I had to figure, and it was common law trade secret, I had to come up with charges based on what the lawyers had suggested in their submissions. I had to do an adverse possession case. There was, until the oil and gas volume was first published, we did not have PJCs on adverse possession. And so I had to try and figure out how to charge adverse possession. And then oil and gas came out with it for oil and gas cases. And I remember we talked about it in oversight and we suggested, hey, we know y'all are oil and gas. We know that you're focused on oil and gas cases, but understand no one else, none of the other volumes have this. So people who are trying adverse possession cases that don't have anything to do with oil and gas are still going to look at this. So let's try and write this to where it's appropriate for oil and gas, but it's also useful for non-oil and gas purposes. And they were receptive to that idea. And don't recall if it's migrated into any of the other volumes yet or not, but it was oil and gas, I believe, that first had adverse possession.
Well, I think the three of us could probably sit here and talk about nerdy jury charge stuff all afternoon.
Absolutely.
We are kind of coming toward the end of our day today and our time with you, Judge. I do want to mention, though, before we go, you did write and present an article at the UT Conference on State and Federal Appeals back this past summer. And we'll link to the paper in the episode description so that our listeners get a chance to take a look at it, because I do think it's really useful for folks to see that and read through it to see what the key changes are. So thanks for sharing that with us. Jody, you want to take the next phase?
Just as we're closing here, it's kind of our tradition at the end to always ask for a tip or a war story. And I wonder, I mean, you've given us a lot of great info about the PJC, but I wondered if you had a specific tip or maybe a war story from trying cases on the bench or anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Sure. I thought about being pithy. Like, if the document camera isn't working, check to make sure the lens camera is off before you tell the judge it's not working. Or more directed to the PJC, look at the PJC before you submit your proposed charge. I had a case, it was a bank fraud case. Plaintiff put together I think it was a $30, $40 million damage model. Proposed charge, the damage question, you know, asked what sum of money, if any, paid now in cash would fairly and reasonably compensate Paul plaintiff, you know, for the fraud you found in question one. And then, you know, you have to do the line items for the specific measures of damages. And line item A was compensatory damages, period. And the defendant objected because that did not adequately guide the jury in what the measure of damages were. And I looked at the plaintiff's attorney, what do you got? And he's like, yeah, I get compensatory damages. And I had to sustain that objection. I gave him all the time possible. I gave him a chance to request an instruction after we did the defendant's objections. And this was actually an example I like to highlight of professionalism, how we can be good lawyers without being mean to each other. The defense lawyer handed him the business and consumer PJC volume so that this guy could try and write up a request of instruction for the damages. He didn't bring his own PJC with him. So that's another one. Bring your PJC with you to court. Also, I would just say I respect the defense lawyer because he could have been a jerk about it and not hinted that he had a PJC, but he said, I've got a PJC. Do you want to look at it? And I think that one of those things where I was proud of our profession, seeing a lawyer do that, because he wanted to win on the merits. He didn't want to win and put this guy into a malpractice case because he forgot his PJC. So those would be my two war story tips, is check the lens camera cap and bring your PJC and look at it beforehand and make sure you know what the measure of damages question is going to look like to the jury.
Well, thank you. Those are great tips. And this has all been great information. We really appreciate you giving us your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.